Just a warning before we start. This episode contains scenes of suicide. If you or someone you know are considering suicide, please call the Suicide and Crisis Hotline 988. Please take care while listening. This is the Bible Book Club. I'm Heather.
And I'm Susan.
And we're in the book of 1 Samuel.
Welcome to the club.
In chapters 28 and 29, David got a promotion, but it was with the wrong king. He was being paid by King Achish, a Philistine who trusts him so much that he appoints David as his bodyguard for life. David's real king, King Saul, does not trust him at all at this point. The Philistines then gather for war. Saul panics. He can't call on God. God is not actually talking to him anymore. So he tries to phone a friend, and that friend was Samuel. He wants to see if Samuel has a word from God. Well, Samuel has some harsh words for our king. Samuel, though, remember, he's dead. So Saul used a medium to contact him. Sorcery, witchcraft, and mediums were forbidden by God, and Saul knew this. Samuel informed Saul that the Philistines would be victorious and he would die tomorrow. Well, back to the Philistines. King Achish wants David with him in the big battle, but the other kings think that's crazy, and to take an Israelite into battle would not be a good idea, battling against their own people, the Israelites. So David and his men are spared fighting against Saul, and they head home.
So David is playing a dangerous game with a lot of moving parts. He's a mercenary soldier deceiving his employer, Achish, who just happens to be in league with four other powerful Philistine leaders. At this time, Achish and their friends are attacking David's people, the Israelites. Achish believes David has been raiding the Israelites, when in fact, he was raiding the Geshurites, Gerzites, and Amalekites. Now, Achish may be fooled about David, but the Amalekites are not. David arrives home after a 3 days journey from, remember when Achish sent him home, and discovers that those very same Amalekites he had been raiding have retaliated and walked off with David's and his camp's women and children. In summary, if you didn't catch all that, David is working for Achish. Achish is attacking David's people. David is attacking Canaanites and lying to Achish about it. And one of the Canaanite tribes, the Amalekites, is raiding David's camp. It is a mess. But God loves a good story. On top of all that, the Amalekites have a long history with Israel. So listen to this. Amalek was the son of Eliphaz, who was Esau's eldest son. Remember, Esau was Jacob's twin brother, and they did not get along. So the Amalekites are cousins to the Israelites. The Amalekites lived in the northern part of the Negev and should have known of God's promise to give the Israelites Canaan. They shouldn't have felt threatened by Israel because of this, but they did. And this could have been a lingering effect of the bad relationship between Jacob and Esau. This is like As the World Turns. Did you track with all that? Long story short is, it's all the twins' fault, Jacob and Esau. They had bad blood, and now it's carried down to these two nations, the Amalekites and the Israelites. All right. The Amalekites were the first nation to attack the Israelites after their escape from Egypt. It was the battle against the Amalekites that was also Joshua's very first battle. It was the famous battle of Moses' arms. Listen to Exodus 17.
Exodus 17, verse 8. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff from God in my hands." So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained steady until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven."
So God promised to blot out the Amalekites, and he reminded the Israelites again about this promise in Deuteronomy 25, 25, verse 17.
Remember what the Amalekites did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt. When you were weary and worn out, they met you on your journey and attacked all who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you in the land he is giving you to possess as an inheritance, you shall blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget.
So the Amalekites attacked the Israelites when they were weak, and that is why God promised to wipe them out. Now here's the Bible bender and why this is so important at this point in our story. Saul knew this, and he was commanded as the first king ever of Israel to wage a harem war against the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15. A harem war was a holy war where everyone and everything was to be wiped out. God promised this. Remember in these verses before, Saul was supposed to take care of it. But Saul could not resist taking a few souvenirs from that battle. He took their king, Agag, and some of their flocks, sheep, herds, whatever they were. Now, his failure to execute the holy war was a spiritual failure that revealed his heart. His desire was for himself, and he did not have a heart for the Lord. It was for this act of disobedience against the Amalekites that Saul lost the kingdom and his heirs and sons being that future line to Christ. Now here, ironically, on the eve of Saul's death, on the eve before the crown passes from Saul to David, it is David who is fighting the Amalekites and will begin to do what Saul failed to do. David dares to obey the Lord while Saul despairs because he has disobeyed the Lord. Scene 1, David's heart for the Lord seeks the Lord.
1 Samuel chapter 30. David and his men reached Ziklag on the third day. Now the Amalekites had raided the Negev and Ziklag. They had attacked Ziklag and burned it and had taken captive the women and everyone else in it, both young and old. They killed none of them, but carried them off as they went on their way. When David and his men reached Ziklag, they found it destroyed by fire and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. So David and his men wept aloud until they had no strength left to weep. David's two wives had been captured, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David was greatly distressed because the men were talking of stoning him. Each one was bitter in spirit because of his sons and daughters.
So picture this. You know, Saul has just learned that he's going to die tomorrow. He's facing the Philistines. David has been sent away from that battle from the Philistines because he's an Israelite, and who's going to invite him to a battle against his own people? The Philistines aren't stupid. He travels 3 days to come home. While he's traveling home, the Amalekites are retaliating against him and they take all the women and children and the flocks and everything. But note, even while all that was going on, this is where it's such a great picture of God being everywhere at one time. God protected David's people. They were captives, but they were not dead. The Amalekites could have wiped them out easily. Interestingly, the men, David's men, are mutinous and talking about stoning David for bringing them into this God-forsaken land of the Philistines. So think of the pressure on David. His heart is with Israel, who's facing battle with the Philistines. He gets home, his family is with the Amalekites, and now his men are turning on him and wanting to kill him because he's the reason they're living in the land of the Philistines being attacked by the Amalekites. This is the first time that we know that David's men question him. They are bitter about the loss of their families, and we can't blame them, but think of David in this moment of pressure.
I bet he wrote a good psalm about it.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
Continuing in verse 6, but David found strength in the Lord his God. Then David said to Abiathar, the priest, the son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. Abiathar brought it to him, and David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue this raiding party? Will I overtake them? Pursue them, he answered. You will certainly overtake them and succeed in the rescue.
What do you do when you're panicked with pressure?
You take the ephod to God.
You take the ephod to God. And that's the whole point of this. That's what David did. Saul and David are both at low points and both call on the Lord for answers. Saul illegally tries to call on the Lord through a medium. David calls through the priest, the right way to do it. Listen to the difference. In chapter 28, verse 6, Saul says this.
Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him by dreams or Urim or prophets.
The Lord did not answer him because he did not have a heart for the Lord. And this was the consequence of his sin. Here in chapter 30, also verse 6, it says,
but David found strength in the Lord his God, and David inquired of the Lord.
And the Lord answered. Note the personalization. David found strength in the Lord his God. Saul never made him his God. It was Samuel's God, but that's why Saul had to go through Samuel in the medium, because he never really owned the relationship. At this moment, Saul and David are both facing tremendous opposition, and both crave the comfort and answers that only God can provide. But God is not a genie in a bottle for us to master. God is the master of the universe, not a distant, unkind master. He wants a relationship with us. David has that relationship with his God. But for Saul, that opportunity has passed. Saul has been making incremental moves away from God for years, while David is moving closer and closer to God. Where are you on the continuum of your relationship with God? Every single day, we have the opportunity to make an incremental move toward God. It is a great question to ask yourself, which I try to do every night before I go to bed. Did I move closer to or further away from God today?
And I'll confess that sometimes it takes me till the end of the day before I remember to do that. When if
yes.
I had just remembered to do it in the moment, but yes. I'm too busy trying to make things happen and trying to fix things and trying to do stuff to stop sometimes and talk to God. And it'll take me at the end of the day, or it'll take my husband going, well, have you prayed about that? And I'll be like, yeah, no, forgot that.
You know, people laugh at me because I use a habit tracker, but I do. And one of my things of the day is I have to like know to check off. I prayed in the morning. I did this. I did this. I did this. And I give myself a grade at the end of the day, and I don't beat myself up if I have a bad grade. I tell you, I have a bad grade, like probably 4 days out of seven, but at least I'm trying to keep track.
Yeah.
Of
and
what
at the
I
end of the day, you remember it too.
Yes. All right. Scene two. David dares to attack the Amalekites because he sought the Lord and has the assurance of victory from the Lord.
Verse 9. David and the 600 men with him came to the Besor Valley, where some stayed behind. 200 of them were too exhausted to cross the valley, but David and the other 400 continued the pursuit. They found an Egyptian in a field and brought him to David. They gave him water to drink and food to eat, part of a cake of pressed figs and two cakes of raisins. He ate and was revived, for he had not eaten any food or drunk any water for 3 days and three nights. David asked him, "Who do you belong to? Where do you come from?" He said, "I am an Egyptian, a slave of an Amalekite. My master abandoned me when I became ill 3 days ago. We raided the Negev of the Kerethites, some territory belonging to Judah and the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag." David asked him, "Can you lead me down to this raiding party?" He answered, "Swear to me before God that you will not kill me or hand me over to my master, and I will take you down to them." He led David down, and there they were, scattered over the countryside, eating, drinking, and reveling because of the great amount of plunder that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from Judah. David fought them from dusk till evening of the next day, and none of them got away except 400 young men who rode off on camels and fled. David recovered everything the Amalekites had taken, including his two wives. Nothing was missing, young or old, boy or girl, plunder, or anything else they had taken. David brought everything back. He took all the flocks and herds, and his men drove them ahead of the other livestock, saying, "This is David's plunder."
Okay, so David takes off with all 600 men. However, 200 are exhausted and stay behind at Besor Valley. The 400 who continue run into this Egyptian slave who had been with the Amalekites but was left behind because he was sick. And God just probably had that happen so they could get some intel. He takes them to the Amalekites in exchange for his life. Now, when David arrives at the Amalekite camp, there is a plunder party going on. David and his 400 men fight for about 24 hours and kill all but 400 who get away. So they must have been seriously outnumbered if it says that all but 400 got away because it was 400 against David's 400 against I don't know how many, but all but 400 got away. David recovered everything. God had protected every wife, child, and animal. He also took what was owned by the Amalekites. So in this case, David was allowed to take the spoils of war as God had not commanded harem or total annihilation. Scene 3, David gives rather than takes because he recognizes the victory and the spoils of victory belong to the Lord. Recall that in 1 Samuel 8, the people clamored for a king and Samuel warned them that a king would take and take and take. It was a prophetic statement that we will see going forward in books to come. There are coming kings who will just take and take and take. But David is the contrast. He is a leader who gives.
Verse 21. Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow him and who were left behind at the Besor Valley. They came out to meet David and the men with him. As David and his men approached, he asked them how they were. But all the evil men and troublemakers among David's followers said, because they did not go with us, we will not share with them the plunder we recovered. However, each man may take his wife and children and go. David replied, "No, my brothers, you must not do that with what the Lord has given us. He has protected us and delivered into our hands the raiding party that came against us. Who will listen to what you say? The share of the men who stayed with the supplies is to be the same as that of him who went down to the battle. All will share alike." David made this a statute and ordinance for Israel from that day to this. When David reached Ziklag, he sent some of the plunder to the elders of Judah, who were his friends, saying, "Here's a gift for you from the plunder of the Lord's enemies." David sent it to those who were in Bethel, Ramoth Negev, and Jatir, to those in Aor, Simtha, Esthma, and Rechol, to those in the towns of the Jerahmeelites and the Kenites, to those in Hormah, Borashan, Athak, and Hebron, to those in all the other places where he and his men had roamed.
David is in the process of becoming a compassionate and giving leader, and he's putting into place rules and laws from the perspective of God's eyes, and everything is God's, and so you give because it's not really yours. First, he was compassionate and fair to the Egyptian first. Then David is fair to the men who were too exhausted to pursue the Amalekites. On top of that, David sends funds to the leaders of Judah. This was a very smooth move, politically and spiritually. Politically, because David needs friends in Judah. Note that Hebron is one of the receiving cities, and it is in Hebron that David will shortly be anointed king of Judah. Spiritually, it was a good move because everything David received in this victory was God's, not his. God gave him the victory, and the Israelites are God's people. Therefore, he gives back. The victory over the Amalekites was huge. David and his men went from having nothing to recovering what they had lost, plus more. On top of that, this was the Amalekites they had defeated, one of Israel's greatest enemies. This is the enemy that had persecuted Moses and Israel when they were weak, the very ones that Saul had disobeyed God about. David sought God, obeyed God, and succeeded where Saul had failed. Now, ironically, at the very same time that David, with his small band of outcast Israelites, is winning a battle against one of Israel's greatest enemies, the Amalekites, Saul is leading the nation of Israel, with thousands and thousands, remember, into a losing battle against the other great enemy of the Israelites, the Philistines. While David dares to obey the Lord and receives a victory, in scene 4, Saul despairs and takes his own life in defeat because Saul disobeyed and sought out a medium and knew that God would not spare him.
Chapter 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel. The Israelites fled before them, and many fell dead on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines were in hot pursuit of Saul and his sons, and they killed his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting grew fierce around Saul, and when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically. Saul said to the armor bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." But his armor bearer was terrified and would not do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men died together that same day.
True to form, Saul does not consider God in the end. The Philistines were ruthless, and Saul's fear of the Philistines was greater than his fear of sin. Therefore, Saul takes his own life, rather than turning to God in trust and accepting God's will for his life. We will never know if it could have been different. If Saul could have redeemed any part of his reign as king with parting words of repentance to God, rather than trying to steal a word from Samuel. Suicide is a tragic choice, but it does not determine the sufferer's opportunity for eternity. I want to make that clear. Sin does not preclude us from heaven. If it did, none of us would make it. It was for sin that Jesus died, for all sin, and for all sinners. Now, if you feel like you've considered suicide, then know this. It is not God's choice for you. You were created by God for his kingdom and for his purposes, and he can redeem you no matter what your situation is. All right, back to our story. There's much irony here. In 1 Samuel 9:15, we read this.
"Now, the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel. About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him ruler over my people Israel. He will deliver them from the hand of the Philistines. I have looked on my people, for their cry has reached me."
Saul had been specifically anointed king to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And yet, at his death, quite the opposite happens. The Philistines wound Saul, kill his sons, and occupy all the surrounding towns. The manner of Saul's death puts a dramatic point on his failure as the first king of Israel. The other irony in Saul's death is that he spent so much time chasing David in fear that David would kill him and remove him from the throne. But in the end, it wasn't David who killed him. It wasn't the Philistines, and it wasn't God. Saul removed himself from the throne by falling on his own sword, which is quite symbolic. Saul had been removing himself from the throne for years. The kingship and kingdom belonged to God. Saul consistently disobeyed God. Consequently, God gave the kingdom to David. Saul's disobedience was his fault. He lost the kingdom through his actions, and in the end, no one took the throne from him. He gave it up. With a final act of disobedience, he killed himself. Saul's suicide was the end result of the many choices he made throughout his life. Now, it was a tragic day for Israel, and not just because of Saul. David lost Jonathan. Jonathan's protection and love for David in the face of his own father was heroic. The fact that he stood by his father and Israel in this final battle with the Philistines, when in his heart he knew the outcome, was more than heroic. It was sacrificial. I can't help but wonder, as we look ahead to the chapters to come, and you're going to hear about these if you've never heard about them before, if David's life would have been better had he benefited from a life of friendship with that faithful Jonathan. I just love that guy. In my head, if he had had that faithful friendship with Jonathan, maybe he wouldn't have been tempted by Bathsheba. Maybe he wouldn't have, you know, had her husband killed. And maybe then, you know, God would have used that sweet Abigail to be Solomon's mother.
Continuing in verse 7, "When the Israelites along the valley and those across the Jordan saw that the Israelite army had fled and that Saul and his sons had died, they abandoned their towns and fled. And the Philistines came and occupied them. The next day, way, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor, and they sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among their people. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths and fastened his body to the wall of Beth-shan.
So this was a tragic day for Israel, not just because of Saul and not just because of Jonathan. It was a tragic loss of land, promised land, that had been occupied by Israel since the time of Joshua, was now occupied by the Philistines. It's like the Canaanites were taking over again. Saul's body is pegged to the wall of Beth-shan. Now, this city stands over the two valleys, the Jezreel and Jordan, guarding access to both. It provided the Philistines with a military stronghold over Israel in the north, which they did not have because the Philistines were kind of more in the south. The Philistine pressure has only grown under Saul, leaving David with a formidable task, which, remember, it was Saul's challenge to take over the Philistines. He has done the opposite. The pressure has grown. Lastly, it was a tragic day for Israel because the reputation of their God was tarnished. The Canaanites looked upon battles as a victory of their God over other gods. The winner was the one who had the more powerful God. This is why the Philistines collected Saul's armor and put it in their temple. It's kind of like a trophy. As they had back in 1 Samuel 5, episode 3, when they took the Ark of God and put it in their temple. Remember that story? Their god Dagon fell over and the Philistines were struck by plagues and returned the Ark because they wanted the plagues to go away. Now the Philistines celebrate another victory over the very first king of Israel. And it looks to them like, hey, their God is winning again. Word of this would have spread far and wide, with many Canaanite tribes rejoicing over the defeat of the mighty God of Israel. This was a painful tragedy for Israel, and most likely a severe blow to their confidence in God. But it also serves as the backdrop for David, that boy who defended the name of God against Goliath, the Philistine giant, is now the man who will defend the name of God against the entire Philistine nation.
Verse 11. When the people of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their valiant men marched through the night to Beth-shan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Beth-shan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days.
So first, I want to point out that it was an act of God that David was not a witness to this battle or the aftermath, when you consider that Jonathan died and all these terrible things happened to Saul's body, because he was the anointed king. The Lord only knows what David would have done. So it was really great that God put David out of the way and he's distracted by the Amalekites. Now, the warriors of Jabesh-Gilead, at risk to themselves, retrieved the bodies of Saul and his sons because Saul was the first anointed king of Israel and he must be honored. But also, they remembered, they did not forget what Saul had done for them. Way back in 1 Samuel 11, Saul began his reign as king admirably by rescuing the city of Jabesh-Gilead from the Ammonites. So this is a full circle moment. The mighty warriors of Jabesh repay Saul and his sons by giving him and his sons a proper, if not traditional, burial. Because it wasn't traditional, because normally the Israelites did not cremate, but it could have been, remember, they marched for days, that the advanced state of decomposure required it. All right, here are my final thoughts on Saul and the book of 1 Samuel. The books of 1 and 2 Samuel are the story of Israel's leadership transition from judges to the first two kings they ever had. Saul, who failed due to pride and disobedience, and David, a man after God's heart. Now, if you remember one thing about these two books, remember that they are about Saul's fall and David's faith. All right, so let's go back to the book of 1 Samuel's opening. And it opened with a prophetic song from Samuel's mother, Hannah. And in that song, think about it, she sang this.
The Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor.
So Hannah, remember her situation. She's singing a song about how God reverses situations. Her infertility was reversed, but she was also singing prophetically a song about David's and Saul's reversal. God humbles and he exalts. And Saul, once exalted, is humbled, while David, once humbled, is exalted. Now, in our next episode and next book in 2 Samuel 1:27, David's going to sing another song that picks up on this theme. And know this, 1 and 2 Samuel begin with a song from Hannah, end with a song from David. But in the middle, there's this other song. Three times in this next song, David will sing,
"How the mighty have fallen."
And three times in this chapter, we read the word fall used to describe Saul's end. Starting in 31:1, we read this.
The Israelites fled before them and many fell dead on Mount Gilboa.
Then 31:4.
Saul took his own sword and fell on it.
And 31:8.
They found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa.
So know this, when we open in 2 Samuel, David's going to sing three times, "How the mighty have fallen." Saul, the king the people wanted, the man who was a head taller than any, has fallen. He was mighty, but he did not have a heart for the Lord. However, as we end 1 Samuel, the author has not left us without hope, despite what Saul has done or become. Because Hannah ended her song with these words.
He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed.
Which has nothing to do with infertility. So now she's in her prophetic vision. Anointed is from a Hebrew word related to Messiah. This is the first mention of the Messiah in the Bible. We talked about this. Hannah was prophesying of Jesus the Messiah, the anointed one who will save his people. Hannah tells us of the coming hope. Therefore, we end 1 Samuel with the death of Saul. Sounds terrible, but in anticipation, because God has provided Israel the hope of a king with a heart for the Lord. King David will pave the way to the King of Kings, the promised king who holds the key to the eternal kingdom. The key that is written about in the final book of the Bible, the book of Revelations. Listen to the words that contain within them my favorite verse in the whole Bible.
Revelation 3:7. These are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name.
So Hannah prophesies in the beginning of 1 Samuel. Then we go through this terrible thing throughout 1 Samuel of, you know, Saul failing as king. But we don't end 1 Samuel without hope, because we know David is that next king and David has the key. Listen to Revelation 1, starting in verse 17 with this.
I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades.
The key of David is the key from death to eternal life, because David is the line of Christ. And Jesus holds that key.
Join us in the next episode, the beginning of season 10, as we continue in 2 Samuel with a new king, the king with a heart for the Lord, the king with the key. What's a club without friends? If you're enjoying the Bible Book Club, why don't you share it? And then you can say,
Welcome to the club.
New episodes drop every Monday, and get all episodes now on Amazon Music. As always, head over to susanmee.com/Bible Book Club for show notes from today's episode. Bible Book Club is hosted by Susan Merrill and Heather Rubio, edited by Buck Buchanan, produced by Haley Mawat.